Hello everyone, before we begin the episode, I would just like to make a brief announcement. As you may or may not have heard, The Trail Went Cold has just partnered with a new streaming service called Get Vocal and joined their True Crime Thursdays lineup, which consists of several notable true crime podcasts. So from now on, every Thursday night from 7 till 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, I will be hosting a live streaming session in which I chat with you, the listeners. I will be discussing the featured case on that particular week's episode of The Trail Went Cold and various other true crime topics, and if you join our interactive sessions, you can ask me questions or chat with me live. I will be providing a direct link to our channel in the show notes, but for more information about True Crime Thursdays, please visit the website getvocal.com/dashboard/truecrime. That's getvocal.com/dashboard/truecrime. Thank you, and enjoy the episode. May 19th, 1990. Madison, Wisconsin. After coming home to grab some food during his lunch break, 19-year-old Chad Maurer tells his parents that he is going to return to his workplace, but he soon goes missing. 2 days later, Chad's body is found in his car inside a garage on the south side of Chicago, and he has succumbed to carbon monoxide poisoning. While the police initially believed that Chad's death was a suicide, there are numerous bruises and injuries on his body which seem to indicate he was the victim of foul play. Chad's parents received information to suggest that he may have been murdered because he became involved with drug trafficking, but there are no conclusive answers about his death. After that, the trail went cold. Hello everyone, and welcome to our latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host Robin Warder, and we've got another bizarre cold case to cover today. The unexplained 1990 death of Chad Maurer. As you might know, this story was featured on Unsolved Mysteries, and I've received numerous requests to cover it since the inception of this podcast. It involves a young man who vanished while in the midst of working a shift at a bicycle shop in his hometown of Madison, Wisconsin, before he turned up dead inside his car, approximately 150 miles away in Chicago. While the Chicago PD was inclined to believe that Chad took his own life via carbon monoxide poisoning, his family would uncover some suspicious discrepancies to suggest he was murdered. The authorities did agree to change Chad's official cause of death from suicide to undetermined, but there are still a number of unanswered questions about what he was doing in Chicago to begin with. I always have a particular fascination with mysteries in which someone goes missing and is subsequently found dead at a location they had no reason to visit on their own. Since Chad was discovered in a particularly bad neighborhood on Chicago's south side, there was speculation that he might have become involved in something illegal, such as drug trafficking, but this has never been conclusively determined. Anyway, just a few weeks after the release of this episode, we will officially reach the 30th anniversary of Chad's death, so I thought now would be an ideal time to tackle it on the podcast. Since this story won't be an overly long one, I'm also going to take a few moments near the end of this episode to talk about another Unsolved Mysteries case, the 1988 death of Kenneth Enge. That story aired on the show about a year before Chad Maurer's case, and also involved a victim being found dead inside of a garage from carbon monoxide poisoning. However, the actual circumstances of how Kenneth Enge died are a lot different, but I'll be talking more about that in a little while. Anyway, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play Music, and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word and garner us more exposure. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, which may include stickers and thank you cards, early access to episodes, and bonus content. So with all that out of the way, let us now explore the unexplained death of Chad Maurer. Our story begins in Madison, Wisconsin in 1990. Our central figure is 19-year-old Chad Maurer, who lives in the Monona suburb with his parents, John and Dolly Maurer. Chad is the couple's only child and graduated high school the previous year, where he had always been a popular student and a talented athlete. Chad is a member of the American Bicycle Association and has a particular passion for BMX racing, as he has collected several trophies after winning a number of races, and is considered to be one of the top 10 BMX racers in his district. He's also very passionate about snowboarding and loves to make weekend getaways to the ski slopes, but following graduation, Chad lost his job and wound up having to sell a motorcycle and a television in order to finance these trips. However, he has just started working a new job at a bicycle shop called the Village Peddler and is hoping to save up enough money to move to Boulder, Colorado and attend college there. In fact, one of the main reasons Chad has his eyes set on Boulder is because it is the home to a number of snowboarding and BMX events which he wants to compete in. On the morning of Saturday, May the 19th, Chad left his home in his father's yellow 1968 Mustang and went to work his scheduled shift at the Village Peddler. It was only his second day on the job, and he would return home at around 12:20 p.m. for his lunch break. He grabbed a few sandwiches and told his parents he was going to go right back to the shop because it was busy there. Chad then asked his father to borrow $20 to purchase gas before driving away, but this would turn out to be the last time his family ever saw him alive. About an hour later, John and Dolly needed to go buy something at the hardware store, which was located just a few doors down from the Village Peddler, but when they arrived, they were surprised to see that their Mustang was not in the parking lot. They decided to go into the bike shop to look for Chad, but no one working there seemed to know where he was. Chad failed to arrive home that night, and when he did not turn up by morning, Dolly started phoning all of his friends, but could not find anyone who knew where Chad was, as the last time any of his friends had seen him was at a party the night before he disappeared. Well, on the evening of May 21st, the Maurers received a surprising phone call from the Chicago Police Department, who shared some horrible news. Chad had been found dead. Not only that, but his body was discovered in an entirely different state, over 150 miles away in Chicago. Earlier that morning, a maintenance worker entered an unlocked garage at a newly constructed housing complex located in Wentworth Gardens, a neighborhood on Chicago's south side. He was surprised to discover the Maurer family's Mustang parked inside, and Chad's body was slumped over in the driver's seat. While the keys in the ignition were turned on, the car had been running for so long that the battery was now dead and the fuel tank empty. Chad's official cause of death would turn out to be carbon monoxide poisoning, and the Chicago PD was initially inclined to believe it was a suicide. In fact, the original report from the Cook County Medical Examiner's Office read, quote, "No foul play is suspected. There was no apparent trauma to the subject." However, Chad's family and friends had a hard time accepting the suicide ruling, as he never showed any signs of depression or suicidal tendencies and had been making plans for the future, which included attending a concert on the same day his body was found. Furthermore, what would have compelled Chad to take a nearly 3-hour drive to Chicago in order to take his own life? As far as anyone knew, Chad had no friends or family members who lived in the city, and he was discovered in one of the roughest neighborhoods, which had a history of gang and drug activity, and a total of 166 murders that particular year. Chad's body was transported back to Madison, but his parents did not actually get to see him until shortly before the start of his funeral on May the 25th. While viewing Chad's body in his casket, John and Dolly were shocked to discover that he had a number of visible marks and bruises on his face and upper body. He also had a swollen upper lip, which had been cut by his teeth, and the knuckles on both of his hands were severely bruised and appeared to have been skinned to the bone. By this point, the funeral director had received the clothing Chad was wearing when his body was found, and he showed it to the Mowers. They noticed that the back of his t-shirt was stained with blood, and he also had skid marks on the seat of his pants to suggest he had been dragged along a hard surface. When the Mowers informed their local law enforcement agency, the Dane County Sheriff's Office, about their new discoveries, the county coroner requested that they delay Chad's burial until a new examination could be performed on his body. They would subsequently discover that Chad had additional bruising on his groin. When asked why the injuries to Chad's body were not mentioned in their original report, the Cook County Medical Examiner's Office defended their decision, stating that since Chad had died from carbon monoxide poisoning, the pathologist believed his injuries had no relation to his death. So therefore, he didn't think there was any reason to make note of them. Well, the Dane County Sheriff's Office arranged for the Chicago PD to send them the police report and the crime scene photos so the Mowers could view them. John and Dolly were surprised to see that a jacket had been photographed on the passenger seat next to Chad's body, and they were certain he did not own such a jacket. In fact, the last time Dolly saw Chad at their home, she asked him if he wanted to take a jacket along, and he said no. The Dane County Sheriff's Office requested to see the jacket from the photos, wanting to know if it was consistent with Chad's size, but by that point, the Chicago PD claimed they had no idea what happened to it and suspected that someone might have taken the jacket before the car was towed out of the garage and secured. The Mowers also noticed what appeared to be smudged bloody fingerprints on one of the Mustang's windows in the photos, but they were never examined. While the original autopsy report did confirm that Chad's cause of death was carbon monoxide poisoning, the level of carbon monoxide in his body was a surprisingly high 74%. Generally, if a person elected to take their own life in this fashion, they would still be conscious at the time, meaning that the level of carbon monoxide in their body would be around 50 to 60% by the time of death. When a person is sleeping or unconscious, they tend to breathe deeper or more methodically, so if Chad was no longer conscious when the carbon monoxide started filling up the garage, this would account for the level in his body being 74%. Chad's boss at the Village Peddler would be interviewed in a local newspaper article about the case and stated that in the days prior to his death, he got the impression that Chad seemed to be afraid of something. Shortly after the article was published, some gunshots were fired through the Village Peddler's front window, and since this did not occur at any other businesses in the area, this seemed to imply that someone was sending a message. It would later turn out that the shots were not actually connected to Chad's case, but the incident wound up compelling the Dane County Sheriff's Office to perform their own investigation. They convinced the Chicago PD to reopen the case, and they would officially change Chad's cause of death from suicide to undetermined. The authorities eventually started receiving information to suggest that Chad had become involved in drugs. A young woman who had graduated high school alongside Chad claimed she once had a conversation with him where he said he had used his car to transport marijuana across Madison. One of Chad's friends would also tell his parents that Chad had been paid to transport a drug dealer to Milwaukee on two separate occasions the previous year. On October the 27th, 1990, a local Crime Stoppers program in Madison aired a segment about Chad's death, and it wasn't long before their tip line received an anonymous call from someone who claimed that Chad had become involved in a drug deal with people who lived in his apartment complex, and that these same people used to live on Chicago's South Side. Police were able to find three people from this apartment complex who had moved from Chicago to Madison only a few weeks before Chad's death, and one of them would later be arrested and sentenced to 27 years in prison for another crime. According to the Chicago PD, they had heard reports about a pipeline of narcotics trafficking from Chicago to Madison. Since he was saving up money in hopes of moving to Colorado, investigators found it plausible that someone could have paid Chad to transport drugs to Chicago before something went horribly wrong. By his own parents' admission, Chad did smoke too much marijuana and had taken LSD a few times in the past, but a toxicology report found no trace of drugs or alcohol in Chad's system at the time of his death. The case would be featured on an episode of Unsolved Mysteries in December of 1991, and when a rerun of the segment aired 5 months later, the show received an anonymous tip from someone in Illinois who reportedly corroborated a lot of the same information Crime Stoppers had received a year and a half earlier. Investigators conceded that perhaps Chad had been tricked into traveling to Chicago and did not even know what he was getting into until it was too late, but they never did uncover any conclusive evidence that Chad was involved in drugs or that it played a role in his death. In 1998, John and Dolly were asked to provide blood samples to compare to the blood found on Chad's clothing in order to help them determine if the blood actually belonged to Chad or if it might have belonged to someone else who attacked him. However, after they provided their samples, the Mowers heard nothing else from the authorities. For years, John and Dolly would run a memorial in the classified section of the local newspapers on the anniversary of Chad's death, in which they urged anyone with information to come forward. Sadly, John and Dolly would divorce in 2007, and while they have both never stopped searching for a resolution, after 3 decades, there are still no answers about what actually caused Chad's death. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. Now, cases in which parents lose a child under suspicious circumstances are always terrible, but it's particularly heartbreaking when they lose their only child, which is what happened with John and Dolly Mower. Dolly had already suffered through multiple miscarriages before she gave birth to Chad in 1970, and they never had any more children, so things were obviously never the same for them after their only son turned up dead. Nevertheless, the Mowers turned out to be incredible advocates for Chad, and never stopped trying to generate publicity in order to find out what happened to him. I just mentioned that every year on the anniversary of Chad's death, they used to publish a memorial forum in the classified sections asking people to come forward if they had information. Sure enough, if you search through the archives of newspapers.com, you'll see that a number of Wisconsin newspapers publish these memorials like clockwork every May. I even turned up one article from 2004, which details John Mower's ventures into BMX racing. John pretty much took it up as a hobby after his BMX-loving son challenged him to try it, and even though John was 61 years old at the time that article was published, he was still continuing to race all these years later in order to pay tribute to Chad. It's sad that John and Dolly ultimately decided to divorce in 2007, but that actually isn't too uncommon in cold cases where parents lose a child, as sometimes, it's just too painful for them to remain together. However, what might have made the situation particularly difficult for them was having to face up to the fact that Chad's death could have been the result of getting himself involved in something illegal. This is an issue I've actually tackled in many of my recent episodes, as sometimes people can be unfairly judgmental about missing or murdered victims because of their personal choices. The primary theory in Chad's case is that he traveled to Chicago and got killed because he was involved in drug trafficking, but regardless of whether or not that's true, that certainly doesn't mean he deserved what happened to him. But I can still see why it's often in everyone's best interest for true crime shows like Unsolved Mysteries to portray their victims in the best light possible. When researching this case, I uncovered articles which revealed that Chad had experimented with drugs like LSD, and his own mother even admitted that he smoked too much marijuana. These tidbits were conveniently left out during the Unsolved Mysteries segment, and while they don't prove that Chad was involved in drug trafficking, they do show that he was not completely averse to drugs. Now, the one fact about this case that I'm sure most people can agree on is that it's very unlikely that Chad's death was a suicide. Yes, the fact that he showed no signs of depression and seemed like a very happy person does not prove that he didn't have suicidal thoughts, but I'm sure the main reason most people were skeptical was because it made no sense for him to drive 150 miles to Chicago just to take his own life. However, I always use the Gail Delano case from Unsolved Mysteries as an example of why this possibility can never be completely discounted. Most of you are probably familiar with that story, but Gail Delano was a depressed single mother from Maine who went missing one day and it would later turn out that she staged her own disappearance and traveled all the way to Mobile, Alabama, before she checked into a hotel under an assumed name and overdosed on pills. So yes, it's not completely out of the question that suicidal people will travel a great distance to another location in order to do something like this, but the problem with Chad's case is that he had a number of bruises and marks on his body to indicate that he had been in a physical confrontation prior to his death. I guess there's a very slim possibility that Chad could have traveled to Chicago, where he was assaulted by one or more persons who left him alive, so he then decided to drive his car into a garage and start the engine so he could intentionally end his own life via carbon monoxide poisoning. But really, the odds of that particular scenario taking place are incredibly slim, and it just seems far more likely that someone beat Chad into unconsciousness before placing his body inside the car and starting the ignition in order to make his death look like a suicide. And this strategy almost worked, since the Chicago PD completely mishandled the original investigation and decided to ignore crucial evidence which pointed towards foul play. If Chad's parents had not gotten the chance to view his body before his funeral and notice all the bruises and marks, he may have been buried without incident, and a new investigation never would have gotten off the ground. Incidentally, I've mentioned before that in the earliest seasons of Unsolved Mysteries, it was not uncommon to see the victims' families portray themselves during the reenactments. But here, it's particularly surreal to see John and Dolly Maurer playing themselves in this scene at the funeral home, and John even acts out an emotional moment where he sees the blood on his son's shirt for the very first time. The Maurers were willing to recreate one of the worst moments of their life on national television, but I guess that just shows the dedication they had towards bringing attention to Chad's case. Anyway, one of the most baffling aspects of this case is that Chad apparently decided to travel from Madison to Chicago while in the midst of working his shift at the Village Peddler. The story goes that Chad returned home on his lunch break to pick up some sandwiches and was supposed to be returning to work, but instead, he drove to an entirely different state. It's interesting how Chad's final interaction with his father was asking to borrow $20 for gas money, which might not have seemed notable at the time, but it's now obvious he did this because he needed to fill up the tank for his long trip to Chicago. And that seems incredibly brazen when you consider that the Mustang actually belonged to his father, not Chad. The Unsolved Mysteries reenactment of the Maurers visiting the Village Peddler later that afternoon and asking the owner if Chad is there is pretty odd, as the owner replies, quote, "Well, he better be here. He may have a customer in the back." I mean, it is a reenactment, so I'm not sure how accurate that dialogue was, but did Chad's boss really not notice he was gone? It might be useful to know if Chad actually returned to the bike shop at any point after he picked up his lunch, or if he just drove straight to Chicago. Considering that it was only his second day on the job, and he was hoping to save up money to move to Colorado, it seems weird that Chad would just take off in the middle of his shift, which is the kind of thing which could get him fired. But then again, if Chad was being paid a great deal of money to do something like transport drugs, then he may not have even cared if he lost his job. I know that gunshots were fired into the Village Peddler shortly after the owner was quoted in a newspaper interview stating that Chad seemed afraid prior to his death, but in a 25th anniversary article published about the case in the Wisconsin State Journal, it was stated that the shots were determined not to have any connection to Chad's case. I have no other information about how they came to that conclusion, but something about the whole situation just seems a little off, and you get the impression that there's a missing piece to this part of the story. I know one theory which has been pushed forward is that something happened to Chad while on his way back to work, and that he was abducted and driven to Chicago in his own vehicle. I don't think that scenario is very likely, but the problem is that there doesn't seem to be any confirmed sightings of Chad from between when he left his home and when he was found dead 2 days later. Anyway, even though no conclusive proof was ever found that Chad was involved in drug trafficking, his parents were told by some of his friends that Chad had transported marijuana through Madison and even gone to Milwaukee on a few occasions, which is about 80 miles away. It's unclear if Chad had ever made any trips to Chicago in the past or knew anybody there, though there was apparently one eyewitness who claimed they had seen Chad skateboarding on Chicago's Oak Street Beach on prior occasions. The only real connection between Chad and the neighborhood he was found were a pair of anonymous tips about how Chad had become involved in a drug deal with three people who had recently moved to Madison from Chicago's South Side. It's really not clear how heavily these three people have been investigated, but the fact that one of them later wound up going to prison for 27 years for another crime suggests that they are not model citizens. But the fact that we know so little about them seems to indicate that the authorities cannot connect these people to Chad through anything besides uncorroborated hearsay from anonymous tipsters. Investigators have even pushed forward the idea that Chad may have been asked to do something for money, but did not realize it involved drugs or anything illegal until it was too late. Now, to be honest, while researching this case, I did detect a few warning signs, which almost made me think that perhaps Chad had a drug problem of his own and may have gotten involved in this world in order to support his habit. Before he was hired by the village peddler, he had lost a previous job and sold off a motorcycle and a television set, supposedly to finance his weekend snowboarding trips, but I have to wonder if he actually needed the money for something else. However, the toxicology report showed no drugs in Chad's system at the time of his death, so I don't want to make any assumptions about a possible addiction problem without evidence, and while he apparently liked to smoke a lot of marijuana, it doesn't look like he was high at the time he was killed. But since Chad was found dead in one of the roughest neighborhoods in the country, it's certainly reasonable to assume that he got himself in way over his head and crossed paths with some very bad people. So now we have to talk about the lackluster investigation by the Chicago Police Department. They somehow lost this mysterious jacket, which was photographed next to Chad's body, even though it could have been a potentially important piece of evidence, and they completely ignored all of Chad's bruises, marks, and injuries, and initially wrote off his death as a suicide. Or rather, they knew these injuries were there, but decided they were completely irrelevant, because the exact cause of death was carbon monoxide poisoning. So, by their logic, if a person is beaten up and thrown off the roof of a building, then the death must be a suicide because it was the fall that killed them, right? When the case was reopened, Sergeant John Ridges, the new investigator on the case, actually stated, quote, "It probably could have been done better, there were some problems, but the Kennedy assassination could have been handled better too," end quote. Well, that's not very reassuring. I guess the big question is, did the Chicago PD intentionally undermine the investigation into Chad's death, or was this just pure incompetence or indifference? Well, I previously mentioned that this particular area of the city experienced 166 homicides that year, so I'm sure the police were overburdened by the high crime rate, and since technically, they could not state with 100% certainty that Chad's death was a homicide, I'm sure they had no qualms about classifying it as a suicide in order to keep the statistics down. Still, considering that Chad was a middle-class white kid from Wisconsin, who was not the typical victim you would find in the Wentworth Gardens neighborhood, you'd think this might have made the authorities more curious about the exact circumstances of his death, but then again, since he was an out-of-towner from another state, perhaps they just took the attitude that he was not their problem. Since the Chicago PD agreed to officially change Chad's cause of death from suicide to undetermined and launch a new investigation, I don't believe they orchestrated an intentional cover-up to protect someone, but I do believe that since they were dealing with so much violent crime during that time period, they were content not to give Chad's case the full attention it deserved. Anyway, the investigators interviewed during the Unsolved Mystery segment do present a theory which I think sounds pretty plausible. Namely, that Chad had been promised a certain amount of money to deliver some drugs from Madison to Chicago, but once he arrived, the people involved decided to renege on paying him because as an out-of-towner without a criminal background, they figured that Chad would not attempt to retaliate if they refused to give him his money. Nevertheless, Chad did not react well, and this led to a violent altercation in which he was severely beaten into unconsciousness. If Chad had just been some local drug dealer or gang member, they might not have thought twice about killing him in a standard fashion, such as shooting him. However, since they knew the murder of an outsider might draw some undue attention, they decided to move the Mustang into an empty garage, place Chad's body in the driver's seat, start the ignition, and then seal him inside, so that he would expire from carbon monoxide poisoning, and people would think his death was a suicide. If the aforementioned people from the apartment complex, who moved from the south side to Madison prior to Chad's death, were involved in this, then they may have received word that Chad had a past history of transporting drugs, which is why they approached him to make a delivery to Chicago. I'm not entirely sure they were in Chicago and personally present when Chad was killed, as the crime may have been carried out by associates of theirs, but at the very least, they probably knew what happened. Again, I really hate to push forward this theory and accuse Chad of being a drug trafficker, since the authorities never found any direct evidence to prove that these allegations about him were true. But it would go a long way towards explaining why Chad wound up dead at a location 150 miles away from home, where he otherwise had no logical reason to be. Since the drug theory could never be corroborated, I do have to wonder what else might have compelled Chad to make that lengthy drive to Chicago. If it wasn't drugs, it had to be something important enough that he decided to just abandon a new job in the middle of a shift. This is another one of those mysteries where you just feel that there's a major piece of the puzzle missing which could shed some light on what happened. But no matter what he had gotten himself into, it must be reiterated that Chad did not deserve what happened to him, and his parents are entitled to receive justice and answers about his death. So if you happen to have any information about the unexplained death of Chad Maurer, please contact the appropriate authorities. So now we're going to take a few moments to talk about another Unsolved Mysteries case involving carbon monoxide poisoning, the death of Kenneth Engie. Our second story begins in 1988 in the small town of Edmore, North Dakota, and our central figure is 25-year-old Kenneth Engie, who works as an auto mechanic. At around 2 a.m. on the morning of October the 4th, Kenneth was drinking at an establishment called Kunkel's Bar, which was on the verge of closing. Kenneth had gotten pretty intoxicated and started hassling the barmaid about taking her home, but she told him she already had a ride with the only other customer left in the bar, another local auto mechanic named Curtis Heck. This angered Kenneth, so a drunken scuffle soon broke out between him and Curtis, which ended with Curtis pinning Kenneth to the floor. He agreed to let Kenneth back up if he would leave the bar without causing any more trouble, so Kenneth got back to his feet and walked out the front door without incident. However, a few seconds later, Curtis heard the sound of a large crash outside, and when he ran into the parking lot, he saw that Kenneth had used his truck to purposely back into the front end of Curtis's own pickup truck before speeding away. The bar soon closed for the night, but the incident ate away at Curtis, so while driving the barmaid home, he decided to make a detour and stop by Kenneth's mobile home. Curtis noticed that Kenneth's truck was parked outside in the driveway, so he went over and started kicking it in order to get even for the damage Kenneth had caused to his truck. However, Curtis then claimed that he heard a groaning sound from inside the garage located next to Kenneth's mobile home. Since the garage door was down, Curtis decided to enter through the back door, and when he walked inside, he saw Kenneth's body lying on the floor about 15 feet away from another pickup truck which belonged to a friend of Kenneth's. Curtis said that Kenneth was still groaning and breathing at the time, and just figured he had passed out because he was drunk. After yelling at Kenneth for damaging his truck, Curtis decided to exit the garage and soon drove away. Well, things took a much darker turn about 12 hours later when Kenneth's uncle, Richard Nygaard, showed up at his residence sometime around 3:30 p.m. When Richard entered the garage, he discovered Kenneth's body on the floor in the same approximate spot where Curtis Heck claimed to have seen him. The police and paramedics were soon summoned to the scene and confirmed that Kenneth was dead. A small pool of blood was on the floor near his head, and a fully loaded .22 caliber rifle was lying about 6 feet away. There were no marks or any signs of physical assault on Kenneth's body, and an autopsy would soon reveal that his exact cause of death was carbon monoxide poisoning. But there was a problem. The ignition key for the truck inside the garage had been turned off, and the truck was not running when Kenneth's body was discovered. The truck's gas tank was nearly full, so it had apparently not been running for very long before the ignition was switched off. So why was Kenneth lying dead on the floor from carbon monoxide poisoning 15 feet away? Well, after learning about the incident at the bar with Curtis Heck, Kenneth's family began to suspect that he was involved in Kenneth's death. When questioned by the Edmore Police Department, Curtis maintained that when he entered the garage and found Kenneth lying on the floor, he was absolutely certain that Kenneth was still alive and making noises at that time, and he saw no indication that the truck was still running and pumping carbon monoxide into the garage. The police had initially leaned towards Kenneth's death being a suicide, but could not explain the ignition key being turned off, so his official cause of death was listed as undetermined. But after performing a full investigation, police ultimately came to the conclusion that Kenneth's death may have been a tragic accident. They theorized that after damaging Curtis's pickup truck at the bar, Kenneth expected that Curtis would drop by his home to confront him, so he grabbed a rifle and sat inside his friend's truck in the garage to wait for Curtis, turning on the engine to keep himself warm. However, since Kenneth was heavily intoxicated, his judgment had been severely impaired, so he soon started feeling the effects of the carbon monoxide. This prompted him to turn off the ignition, climb out of the truck, and head towards the door, but before he could make it there, he collapsed onto the garage floor and passed out. If Curtis was telling the truth, then Kenneth still would have been alive when Curtis entered the garage, but he succumbed to the effects of the carbon monoxide poisoning shortly after Curtis left. The police believed that no foul play had taken place, and considered the case to be closed, but Kenneth's family disagreed. They attempted to pressure the state's attorney's office into charging Curtis for his role in Kenneth's death, but the request was declined due to lack of evidence. The story caught the attention of Unsolved Mysteries when Kenneth's brother sent them a newspaper clipping, so they decided to feature the case on an episode which aired in November of 1990. But in spite of this, there would be no further developments in the investigation. Now, this is the point where I would ordinarily say, the trail went cold, but to be quite frank, I really don't think that expression applies in this particular case. This is one of the few Unsolved Mysteries segments about someone's death where I had to ask, why was this even featured on the show? Well, actually, in a way, I can understand why they went with this case, because as far as mysteries go, it does have a compelling hook. How could someone have died from carbon monoxide poisoning inside a garage if the vehicle's ignition was turned off? But the problem is that this particular detail pretty much signified that no crime had actually taken place, but I'll talk more about that momentarily. There are a number of odd things about this segment, including the fact that it's one of the few Unsolved Mysteries cases I know of which does not feature a photograph of the victim. If you do a Google search on Kenneth Enge, the only photos you'll find are stills from the Unsolved Mysteries reenactment, which show the actor who played Kenneth lying on the garage floor. There's also a Find a Grave entry for Kenneth, which features a photo of his headstone, but no pictures of Kenneth himself. So I have no idea what the guy really looked like. I also cannot find any other information about this case online, aside from a 1990 newspaper article from the Bismarck Tribune, which mentions the filming of the Unsolved Mysteries segment. But honestly, even though the circumstances of Kenneth's death are very strange, and I definitely feel sympathy for his family, I really don't see how they could honestly believe that foul play was involved, or that anyone could be charged for this. I mean, it would be one thing if this was like Chad Maurer's case, and Kenneth had a ton of bruises and marks on him, but even though he had been in a minor physical altercation earlier that night, there were no signs of him being assaulted. The small pool of blood on the floor easily could have been caused by him falling down and hitting his head, and the rifle found at the scene was never fired, so there's no indication of a violent attack. I think the theory that the police presented about what happened is a pretty logical one. The Unsolved Mysteries segment tries to ramp up the air of mystery by having Robert Stack ominously ask questions like, why would a trained mechanic like Kenneth do something as dangerous as run a vehicle's engine inside an enclosed space? If he was overcome by the carbon monoxide fumes, how could he have had the clarity of mind to cut the ignition, but still be unable to reach the nearest door? Well, the simple answer to all these questions is, he was very drunk. I can definitely understand why Kenneth's family would be so inclined to believe he was a victim of foul play, because the official version makes his death seem pretty senseless and avoidable. During his Unsolved Mysteries interview, Curtis Heck does come across as a pretty believable straight shooter, and I always get a laugh when he talks about his drunken scuffle with Kenneth in the bar and says, quote, "Neither one of us were Muhammad Ali." You get the sense that it eats away at him, that he walked into the garage and saw Kenneth lying on the floor, but just left him there. Curtis just assumed that Kenneth was drunk and passed out, and said that under normal circumstances, he probably wouldn't have left someone on the ground in that condition. But hey, the guy had just broadsided and damaged his truck, so Curtis was pretty pissed off at the time. In a way, he showed admirable restraint by just walking away, rather than attacking Kenneth while he was on the ground. Curtis was also adamant that Kenneth was still alive at the time, and the truck was not running, so he had no idea that carbon monoxide had been pumped into the garage. While there was immature behavior on both men's parts over the situation, I'm sure Curtis never would have wished death on Kenneth, and I really don't think there's any way you could hold him criminally liable for his actions. So here's my biggest issue with this segment. Kenneth's uncle, Richard Nygaard, is interviewed, and he disputes Curtis's story and the police's version of events. He believes what actually happened is that Curtis went into the garage, got into a fist fight with Kenneth, and knocked him unconscious. Before he left, Curtis noticed that the truck was still running, so he was the one who went over and turned off the ignition key. But by that point, it was too little too late, and there was already enough carbon monoxide in the garage that Kenneth wound up succumbing to it before he woke up. But hold on a second here. If Kenneth's family believes that Curtis turned off the truck's engine, then how can they reasonably expect him to be charged with murder? Even if Curtis was angry enough with Kenneth to punch him out, the fact that he went to the trouble of turning off the ignition would seem to indicate that he still had enough concern for Kenneth's well-being that he did not want him to die of carbon monoxide poisoning. So technically, we have a victim's family accusing a suspect of murder while simultaneously presenting an alternate theory which absolves said suspect of murder. If the truck had still been running when Kenneth was found, then you might have an argument that Curtis intentionally left him to die, but as it is, the evidence really doesn't point towards this being anything more than a tragic accident. If Curtis was the person who turned off the ignition, then I don't see why he would deny that, since it actually paints him in a bit of a more positive light. They really don't go into this during the Unsolved Mysteries segment, but since Curtis was giving the barmaid a ride home, I'm sure the police spoke to her to confirm Curtis's story, and she likely verified that he was only inside Kenneth's garage for a few moments, and would not have had nearly enough time to orchestrate a murder. No, I really think that the police's theory of Kenneth turning off the ignition himself and collapsing before he made it out of the garage is probably the correct one. This is one of those mysteries which might seem perplexing on the surface, but once you think about it, the solution is a rather simple one, and it's obvious that no foul play took place here. While I question why Unsolved Mysteries elected to feature the story, and actually wound up making the case for foul play in Chad Maurer's case look all the more stronger when that story was featured 1 year later. Anyway, that about wraps up this week's episode. If you have your own thoughts about what happened in either of these cases, feel free to leave me a comment or send me an email to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Another reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. We produced a bunch of exclusive bonus episodes for our patrons in tiers 2 and 3, and this past month, we produced an episode about the very first final appeal segment ever featured on Unsolved Mysteries, involving the controversial conviction of Glenn Consagra for the double murder of his friends, Freddie Doberly and Mary Lou Holmes. And for our patrons in Tier 3, I've also recorded another new audio commentary track, which can be played over a classic episode of Unsolved Mysteries. So to learn more information, feel free to visit our Patreon page. I'd also like to give a shout out to our most recent listeners who have signed up with us on Patreon this week, and they are Maddie F, Pip L, Athena B, Rachel A, Jen R, Kenny F, Sabi W, and Dana M. Thank you all so much for your support. And before we bring this episode to a close, I would just like to take a few moments to recommend a new podcast. The word forensics often brings to mind the image of white lab coats and latex gloves, but forensic detectives actually spend their days rushing from crime scene to crime scene with no resources to help them deal with the emotional trauma that follows. And the new podcast, Shattered Souls, A Forensic Detective's Diary, brings you this side of the story. Brought to you by CrimeCon, Shattered Souls follows forensic detective veteran Karen Smith as she revisits her poignant and detailed journals to share the stories of victims you've likely never heard of, but whom she can't forget, as well as the shattered souls left behind in their wake. CrimeCon presents Shattered Souls debuts May the 9th on your favorite podcast streaming platform, so to learn more, please visit crimecon.com/podcast. That's crimecon.com/podcast. I also just wanted to give another shout out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. I need to provide a big thanks to Miguel Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or review on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play Music, or Spotify. So have yourselves a great week and join us next Wednesday for another brand new episode of The Trail Went Cold. Thank you.